Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. It's Monday morning, December 23rd, 2019. In a number of recent episodes here, I have been absolutely hammering on efforts to create or pass so-called sanctuary resolutions in Virginia because resolutions are non-binding political statements with no legal effect, and therefore, those sanctuary resolutions being passed in Virginia are claiming to be something that they're not. They are not sanctuaries. But that doesn't mean that resolutions in and of themselves are worthless and should never be used. The point is to focus primarily on being honest about what you're doing so the general public knows what's coming next. Now, in fact, tomorrow in history, on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1798, some of the most important non-binding resolutions, political statements in history were passed in Virginia. So I'm going to talk about those drafted by James Madison, plus similar resolutions drafted and passed in Kentucky, drafted by Thomas Jefferson. And then, of course, the same advice decades earlier from the penman of the Revolution, John Dickinson. First of all, before getting to that, my name is Michael Bolden. We are broadcasting live as we do every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time from here in my home office and studio in downtown Los Angeles for the 10th Amendment Center. We have a bunch of different platforms. We're on both video and then audio-only podcast editions. Our live streams are video through YouTube, Facebook, DLive, Periscope, and Twitch. We have archived versions at Brighteon.com, BitChute.com, and BitTubers.com. Plus, of course, the podcast editions, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and elsewhere. All of those places, all of those platforms, all the ways to follow us, the ways to support us, subscribe to our newsletter, become a member, get all the archives, the show notes, the links that I reference in each episode. Find all that information over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/Path to Liberty. Again, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/Path to Liberty. Now let's take a quick look over in the live chat. I just want to say hello to everyone joining me live, and I know it's Christmas week, so first of all, a very happy holiday and a very Merry Christmas to you, whatever you happen to celebrate or not. I'm very grateful for you spending some time with me today, whether it's before Christmas or you're listening later on in the archives or watching. Thank you so much for being here. Hi to my good buddy Sherry Voluntary over on Facebook. I just did an interview with her last week. I don't know, time kind of all blends together. I think it was sometime last week. I did a bunch of interviews last week. Over on YouTube, Tim Truth, Kim Folds, Chris Folds, sorry, not Kim Folds, Liberty Howell, The Essential Freedom, Justin Bayola, and everyone else. I'm so grateful for you guys spending some time with me. Of course, if you like the show, smash that like button, leave comments, whether it's live or in the archive, all that stuff, including sharing links and things like that, that triggers the algorithms of the platform you're on to show the program to more people. Okay, enough babbling for me. Let's do a little walk down history lane, memory lane, and go to 1767 and look at the New York Restraining Acts, which was the first of the five Townsend Acts passed in the summer of 1767. Let me see if I can pull this up here on the screen for you guys to see. The New York Restraining Act, and I'm looking just at the wiki page, which has a good basic overview. I don't always rely on wiki, but this one's solid. This is the first of the five acts passed on June 5th, 1767. It forbade the New York Assembly and the governor of New York from passing any new bills until they agreed to comply with the Quartering Act of 1765, which required them to pay for and provide housing, food, and supplies for British troops in the colony. New York resisted the Quartering Act because it amounted to taxation without representation. It was a mandate since they had no representatives in Parliament. So the short version was, Parliament demanded that they do something under a previous act. This is a follow-up to the Stamp Act. And then New York just didn't participate, at first at least. And so then Parliament followed up and said, well, we're shutting down your legislature, your assembly. And that'd be like Washington, D.C. telling the state of California that they aren't allowed to pass any new... Not that I want any new laws, But if there's going to be bad laws or good laws passed, they really should be on a state or a local level, at least in a federalist system here in the U.S. So they shut down the New York Assembly in response to not just the New York Restraining Act, but the entirety of the Townsend Acts, the penman of the Revolution. That's John Dickinson. He wrote a series of letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania. There were 12 letters over 1767 and 1768 that I've covered here a number of times on this show, and we've written about many times on the 10th Amendment Center website. And he talks about in his very first letter, this New York Restraining Act. He talks about the principles behind it and the fact that even though he didn't think it was a good strategic idea for New York to do this at this time, the response from Parliament was a restriction on freedom and it was very bad. And he points out, he says, with concern, this is near the end of his first letter after explaining the whole situation. I have observed that two assemblies of this province in Pennsylvania have sat and adjourned without taking any notice of this act to their friends over in New York. It may perhaps be asked what would have been proper for them to do. And Dickinson is saying, look, here in Pennsylvania, even though this isn't affecting us directly right now, the principle being established is incredibly important and potentially very dangerous for everyone. At some point, he wrote in the letter, said, if Parliament can restrain her rights in New York on this, they can restrain the rights of anybody else in any other province or any other colony at any other time in the future. And so he's saying, look, we got to do something. And he goes a little bit further. He talks about, you got to think strategically. And in his position, his strategic position was not to push too far, but at least take a first step. And that is, in essence, he said, it appears to me it would have been sufficient for the assembly to have ordered our agents to represent to the king's ministers their sense of the suspending act and to pray for its repeal. And what he's really saying there is we should send a message to the king's ministers, to Parliament, and tell them that we oppose this. This is the same as passing a non-binding political statement in the form of a resolution today. This is the same concept. Just telling the world and telling the people involved that we're not in favor of this. We don't want to see this happen. That's step one. He said, thus we should have borne our testimony against it and might therefore reasonably expect that on a like occasion, we might receive the same assistance from the other colonies. And he ends this with a Latin phrase, which I've covered here. It's actually on our membership cards. This is our logo, or this is our tagline, not the logo, the tagline here at 10th Amendment Center, and that's Concordia res parve crescunt. Small things grow great by concord. And so here, the penman of the revolution, he said, take one step. When they go after rights, even if you don't feel that the right approach in response is all-out resistance, the first step is a non-binding political statement, a resolution. So we know that this has a long tradition, a long history in the American revolutionary tradition going back to the 1760s. We found this even further back in the Stamp Act as well. The Virginia Resolves, for example, drafted by Patrick Henry, were incredibly important in the resistance to the Stamp Act. And Dickinson is just taking this to the next step. Now, I'm not going to get into too many details here on these resolutions passed in Kentucky and Virginia, but a quick reminder, during the summer, and this is from an article written by Mike Meharry about 5.5 years ago. This is summer of 2014. He says that during the summer of 1798, Congress passed four laws together known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. He goes on and says the most insidious of the laws was the Sedition Act. It essentially criminalized criticism of the federal government, a blatant violation of the First Amendment. He goes on, he says, recognizing that the Alien and Sedition Acts represented a serious threat to the constitutional system and with few options for addressing the overreach due to Federalist Party control of the federal government, Jefferson and Madison turned to the states. Now, Madison years earlier, about a decade earlier, in Federalist 46, this was an early 1788, I believe it was. So just a little a year and a half earlier from this, Madison advised four steps to deal with federal overreach, whether constitutional and just bad policy, or exercising powers not delegated to the federal government. And one of them was create mass noncompliance by the people and using legislative devices to do the same on the state level. Now, sometimes those legislative devices might be a little different. And this is a legislative device that was passed just about a decade later in Kentucky in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts. So Jefferson drafted the Kentucky resolutions, and the Kentucky legislature passed a revised version, Mike writes, on November 10th, 1798. It was passed on November 10th in the House. The Senate passed it a few days later. It was signed by the governor on November 16th. Again, this was not a law being passed in Kentucky. The Kentucky resolutions were a non-binding political statement starting the process of opposing the Alien and Sedition Acts, just like Dickinson advised that the colonies should do in response to the New York Restraining Act in 1767. Mike goes on, asserting that, quote, the several states composing the United States of America are not united on a principle of unlimited submission to their general government, Jefferson proclaimed that nullification was the proper response to deal with unconstitutional acts. So after it was signed on November 16th, he sent a letter along with a draft of the resolutions that were passed to his friend James Madison. And I've covered this a number of times, but I think it's incredibly important to repeat. In his letter, he said this, I enclose you a copy of the draft of the Kentucky Resolves. I think we should distinctly affirm all the important principles they contain so as to hold to that ground in the future and leave the matter in such a train as that we may not be committed absolutely to push the matter to extremities and yet may be free to push as far as events will render prudent. What's the short version of that? We draft in response to a bad government action. We draft a non-binding political statement establishing our principled opposition. Not a kind of a milquetoasty, so-and-so weak sauce opposition, but our total position in a non-binding resolution. Then our follow-up, we need follow-up from there. Literally just saying Constitution is violated doesn't stop government from violating the Constitution. We know, for example, in Federalist 48, James Madison referred to even the Constitution being proposed for ratification, that he was so influential in drafting and then arguing in favor of ratification for. He even said in Federalist 48 that the Constitution itself was a mere parchment barrier. And parchment barriers, the fact that he used this term, he's like, look, we may have beautiful prose, beautiful words on a document, but words on paper don't enforce themselves. That's my paraphrasing version of it. But that's what James Madison was telling us. We know that no matter what you write down, the nature and essence of government is power. And power in human hands, Madison put it, is always liable to abuse. So just telling them that they're violating the rules given to them, the fact that they're doing it in the first place, they're not going to listen to that. But instead, what it's done, why the resolutions were drafted, were to draw attention to the issue, to rally other people to the cause, to establish those principles for posterity, for all future. For us today, we're still talking about the Kentucky resolutions here today, a couple of centuries later. So it's important to establish those principles, but then look on the ground. What are the practical circumstances on the ground? What can we do step by step to achieve those principles? So, but you don't want to push to extremities, because when you get to an extreme situation, this is basically the same thing that Dickinson was saying in response to the Townsend Acts. Jefferson was saying the exact same thing. And I think many people would consider Jefferson a bit more of a radical. And Dickinson was probably more the moderate middle ground kind of guy. But he's still saying, look, we have to be free to push as far as events render prudent. So if we only establish half the principles and we really don't take a solid position on something, and then if we push all the way to those principles, we've only gotten halfway there. So you always have to establish the base foundation and then look at the situation and take step by step to get as far as you can and then continue to follow up. So Mike goes on, he says, Madison got that letter. So this was in mid to late November that Madison got that letter from Jefferson with news of the passage of the resolutions, and he started drafting them. So he drafted those resolutions for Virginia and declared the Alien and Sedition Acts unconstitutional. Madison, Mike writes, also asserted that the states had an obligation to act against egregious federal exercises of undelegated power. It wasn't just a good idea. It wasn't a suggestion. In fact, Madison said that the states are in duty bound to interpose to arrest the progress of evil. Let me see if I can find that exact quote here. Maybe I've got it pretty close. Okay. So, oh, yeah, here it is. He said, in case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, that's the Constitution, the states who are parties thereto, and he clarified in his report of 1800, basically going into detail about what these resolutions were doing. A couple of years later, he said, when he's referring to the states here, he means the people of the several states. The states who are party thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil and for maintaining within their respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. In short, again, this is a non-binding. A lot of people believe, and we've heard over the years, that the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, well, they nullified the Alien and Sedition Acts. They did no such thing. They never claimed to do such a thing. They never claimed to stop the Alien and Sedition Acts. They never said that they caused them to be declared void and unconstitutional. They merely made the case for that. They said that it was the opinion of that assembly that these are unconstitutional, and they called on the other assemblies, the state assemblies or legislatures, to do the same. So this was the beginning of Madison's draft. He gave his draft to his friend Wilson Carey Nicholas, who then brought him over, was also a friend of Jefferson. And in a letter dated November 29th, 1798, Jefferson recommended adding more emphatic language. Of course, always Jefferson would be telling Madison, get a little bit more backbone in this, declaring the Alien and Sedition Acts unconstitutional. And he wanted him to say that the acts are ab initio null, void, and of no force or effect. Very similar to what they did in Kentucky. He said, I should like it better, health, happiness, and adieu. That's pretty cool. So John Taylor of Caroline introduced Madison's resolutions with Nicholas's addition. That was, they were not law, but utterly null, void, and of no force or effect on December 10th, 1798. Now, mind you, passage of this resolution, again, the point of this whole episode is that the resolutions are important, but the resolutions had no legal effect. We're still talking about James Madison's resolutions today. Thomas Jefferson's resolutions today, John Dickinson's advice to pass such resolutions today, hundreds of years later. Well, 200-ish. We're closing in. We can round up. And John Taylor described the resolutions, quote, as a rejection of the false choice between timidity and civil war. In other words, timidity is just sitting there and taking it. Civil war is an all-out battle immediately. And that's generally what we hear from a lot of groups on the ground these days. You only have a choice of voting the bums out, taking what they give you, go to court, or a violent revolution. And Jefferson and others, Taylor of Caroline, Nicholas, Madison, they thought that state-level resistance was considered the moderate middle ground. That's what you're supposed to be doing in the first place. That's what Madison said in Federalist 46. Now, in the course of the debate, Mike writes, Jefferson's suggested wording was removed, but during the period following the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, there was a lot of talk of outright revolution. So people on the ground in Kentucky, Virginia, and elsewhere were pretty, those were the primary hotspots. He goes on, he says, both the Kentucky and Virginia legislatures went to great pains to strike a balance between a hard line and moderation. They wanted to make their point, but they did not want to spark violence. So considering this is what Jefferson advised, like, look, let's establish our principles, but let's not create a situation where we're pushing things to the extreme yet, because we have to rally other people to the flag, bring other people to the cause, so we can bring these unconstitutional acts to an end. What do I have here? Oh, next. So what happened? The Virginia House of Delegates passed the resolutions on December 21st, 1798 by a vote of 100-63. And on Christmas Eve that year, December 24th, the Senate followed suit with a 14-3 vote. That's a nice Christmas gift from James Madison. We sent out an email over the weekend commemorating the December 21st passage in the House of Delegates. This is a timeless Christmas gift from the father of the Constitution, these principles asserting the right and power of the states to interpose to arrest the progress of the evil when it comes to the federal government. And Mike closes this out saying, taken together, the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions lay out the principles of nullification, but they did not actually nullify the Alien and Sedition Acts. These non-binding resolutions merely made the case and set the stage for further action. We know through correspondence between Jefferson and Madison over that period and shortly after that they did intend this to be just a starting point. In fact, we know already from that first letter that Jefferson sent to Madison on November 16th. He's like, look, this is just, we have to hold the ground in the future of our ultimate principles, and then we have to consider the situation on the ground and take steps to bring these things to an end. And that's exactly what they did. Meharry ended up doing an entire ebook on this. And if you're friends of my friend Tom Woods or follower Tom Woods, Tom has done such a great job doing ebooks. We've kind of followed his trailblazing path on this. I know other people do this, but we've put out a number of free ebooks. This one is a great one we published a few years ago, The Jefferson Letters, Volume 1, The Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions. And I think there are 10 letters that Mike included in this. Yeah, he says, you'll find 10 letters between these three men. That's Wilson Carey Nicholas, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison to understand their strategy, what they were talking about. And so he reproduced those in their entirety, added some commentary, some explanations to them. I'll include a link to that. If you want to download that, it's not one of those things where you have to subscribe to our newsletter and then get blasted by a bunch of emails, or you don't have to buy anything. You literally, right here on this page, you can download the thing. Well, there's a link to it. Just the only thing you have to do is click a link to get the free download. That's it. And you're not going to have to sign up for anything, give your information, leave your name, anything. You can get a free PDF version, Kindle, Apple Books, whatever. We don't need to know who you are, where you got it from, and you're welcome to pass it around to as many people as possible. We want people to learn, and hopefully you can enjoy that. So again, the bottom line here, the point that I'm trying to make and hopefully making clear is that when I go after resolutions in Virginia or Texas or elsewhere these days that are making a claim of being a sanctuary when they're really just a non-binding political statement, the problem is that they're claiming to be something that they're not. And then if we're talking about Jefferson's advice to establish principles. If you watched my episode on Virginia Second Amendment sanctuaries, it was last week, maybe Wednesday of last week. Basically, I went through some of the problematic parts of the resolution template that's being passed around and actually voted on by a few dozen counties in Virginia. It's also the same thing that's being passed in places like Illinois and elsewhere. It's almost the same resolution almost everywhere. And there are some very problematic parts of that resolution. They establish very weak sauce, is how I put it, weak sauce principles. Oh, there are some things that may have been passed in the Virginia legislature and in Congress that may infringe on the right to keep and bear arms. No, that's not what you should be saying. If we're talking about establishing principles, the number one principle we should be establishing is that the right to keep and bear arms is a natural right. It is not granted by government. It is our birthright. And we could say the same thing about the right to free speech, the right to privacy, all these other things that government infringes on all the time. Whatever the issue is, you take that same approach, you establish the principle. Then you talk about how the government under the Constitution, whether we're talking the state or the federal Constitution, is not authorized to do what it's doing. and then you talk about what you think that your locality or your state or commonwealth should be doing in response to it. And that's establishing a good principle. And then you take the next step and you follow up from there with whatever strategy, what events will render prudent, as Thomas Jefferson put it. Now, I don't have a lot more to cover on this particular episode, but I want to take a look over in the live chat. Essential freedom, always add in some good quotes, said the powers delegated by the proposed constitution of the federal government are few and defined. Those are which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and definite. That's always a good one to cite. Federalist number 45. Funky euphemism says by themselves completely meaningless. And maybe we're talking about resolutions in general. Again, I would not say that all resolutions are meaningless. It depends on the situation. I think in most situations today, the time is far beyond non-binding resolutions, but maybe to establish a first step. So here at the TAC, back in 2008 or so, we were definitely on board with states passing what we were calling at the time 10th Amendment resolutions, establishing the principle passed by legislatures in the states that the federal government was only authorized to exercise those powers delegated to them, and when they should they pass beyond those lines, beyond those delegated powers, the states would need to take action. That's basically the concept that we're getting out of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798, Dickinson's advice in the Townsend in response to the Townsend Acts of 1767 and the New York Restraining Act. But then you have to follow up. If you just say you're going to do something, and then you don't follow up, you're a political grandstanding piece of garbage. For example, in the Tennessee legislature, seeing Sherry might still be here. I always see Alan Mosley from the Gold Standard podcast show up in the live chat, but I haven't seen Alan yet. But also in Tennessee, a few years ago, we were working to try to get a follow-up to a bullion depository, which has been implemented and is being built and opened in Texas. We are working with a number of people in Tennessee to do the same. So supporters of that, it looked like in the legislature, wanted to take the first step of passing a resolution saying this legislature should research and look into establishing a bullion depository in Tennessee, similar to what's been done down in Texas. Now, I'm not sure if they actually said similar to Texas, but basically they said, let's do this. The resolution, non-binding, passed by huge numbers. Maybe it was like 3 dissenting votes all around between the House and the Senate. It doesn't go to the governor because this is just what the legislature is saying. So, of course, and we always kind of, every time we hear resolution on a state or a local level, we generally look at it. My instinct tells me they're just grandstanding. They want to get it on the record that they were in favor of this, the politicians that work on these. And then they don't really do a follow-up. It's rare to see a real follow-up on these things. So, of course, in Tennessee, the follow-up was absolutely nothing. And we have been hitting up the original sponsors and some co-sponsors and people who voted on that for a number of years. I think that was maybe like 2015. For maybe 2 or 3 years in a row, we reached out to them. Crickets. So that tells me that the resolution was garbage. It was only there. I mean, the resolution itself was worded well, but the motivation of the politicians, who you shouldn't trust ever in the first place, was just grandstanding. They really weren't on board. They made this flowery language saying they were in support of sound money in Tennessee and didn't follow up with even an attempt, not even a bill that would be voted down, but they didn't even try to follow up. So to me, that's political grandstanding. And we generally see that on resolutions, whether it's on a state or a local level. It's an opportunity to do some partisan hackery, to take a position on something, but not really take a position on something either. I see over in the live chat that Tim Truth said, I've just found 10th Amendment Center on Brighteon and have been sharing the VA vids around the Virginia videos. That's awesome. Thank you very much. I love being on Brighteon. Mike Adams has always been kind to us. He actually used to host our podcast that we used to do a few years ago that I ran for a couple of years that they was just hard to keep up with at that time. Florida 10th, good to see Andrew out there. Excellent information as always. Good to see Dwayne Wood out in Bullhead, Arizona. And let's take a look at some of the other things. Alaska, Kansas, and Texas did this with federal gun laws. Well, Alaska and Kansas actually passed legislation, but There are some kind of technical issues. I really need to do an entire episode and an article on the situation in Kansas because there are some really complicated. There's a number of layers. Texas has not actually gotten anything done on this yet. We keep seeing efforts from Representative Matt Krause or Krause, who's in the Fort Worth area, to pass legislation to ban the state from participating in federal gun control. But we haven't seen it actually get passed because it gets blocked by the Senate president every single time. Essential freedom. Interferences of the measures of different states form a great part of the history of our political system. Oh, I have not. If you've got a link to that essential freedom, feel free to post that or actually email it over to me as well. That's good. Sherry Voluntary says it's good to caution against violence. Absolutely agreed. I hear a lot of people talk about using violence today, but they always assume it's going to go their way. It could just as easily work to further bind you. Then you're in a worse position and you've legitimized the use of force against you. And this is something that I often mention. I went to go see a great writer, Chalmers Johnson, who's passed away. He is known for writing a series of books on the sorrows of empire, on the military interventionism of the U.S. military empire. This is a right-wing cold warrior guy who was a CIA asset in Southeast Asia for many years, an expert. Ron Paul has cited his series of books, the Blowback Trilogy, a number of times, for example, when he was running for office. It's really incredible stuff. Well, I went to go see him in maybe 2007 or so, sometime before he passed away. And he basically said, you know, a lot of people like to talk revolution, fighting back. He said, but you only really know about the successful revolutions in history. American Revolution is more of an outlier. He said, most of the time when there's a very tragic event or people fighting back, what you do is you establish a situation, or if there's an economic collapse, what happens is you end up with a stronger tyrant. Mao, he would give as an example over and over. So it is very dangerous to talk about violence. We don't actually support the use of violence. James Madison specifically did not advise the use of violence in these types of situations. If we're going to follow the founders' advice, in Federalist 46, Madison said when the federal government does stuff they're not supposed to be doing, refuse to cooperate. And until we see a lot of people actually doing this, because we know that enough people are on our side, you shouldn't even be looking at the next step at all. And Sherry's also right. Mike Meharry is so amazing. Uriah Thompson asks, what's the follow-up actions to drafting resolutions? Well, it depends. And I think that is the tough part, because Jefferson was very clear in a huge gray area. He basically said, first you have to establish the ultimate principles. What are we talking about dealing with? And then we want to push as far as events will render prudent. Well, maybe in response to your resolutions, no one else rallies to the cause. Well, then what's the next step? The next step might be to visiting people in other areas, in other states, in other counties, in other cities, and talking to them and convincing them. Now, if you get a lot of people passing the resolutions, it might be a different story. Now, Virginia, for example, is a tough nut to actually go through a process here, because most of the resolutions being passed are garbage. They're creating a false reality for a lot of people. They're claiming to be something that they're not, and then a lot of the language in the resolution isn't actually even well crafted. So it's hard to hold to the ultimate principle when the ultimate principle isn't even listed in most of the resolutions being passed. I wish I had one handy here. Maybe I can pull one up if you guys are really interested in this. No, I'm using the wrong keyboard. It's not going to be easy. I will try to put a link to it. But basically, the resolutions don't talk about the right to keep and bear arms being a natural right. It doesn't talk about all gun control measures being unconstitutional in violation of Article 1, Section 13 of the Virginia State Constitution. It doesn't talk about the federal gun control measures all being unconstitutional. It just merely says there might be some things that have been passed or might be being proposed that might restrict our right to keep and bear arms. This is not a strong stand. This is not a strong principled stand on the right to keep and bear arms. And that's what Uriah is asking. Like, what do you do if they have no teeth? And I don't even know if teeth is the right right word for it. You just have to have good principles in there. And once you establish those principles, you have to see how many people are willing to rally to that same cause. So if one county were to pass a really good non-binding resolution supporting the right to keep and bear arms and opposing state and federal gun control measures, who knows how many other counties will follow suit? We see a lot of them doing this on poorly worded, weak, non-line in the sand ones. So maybe all of them would follow suit. Maybe not. Maybe all of them, many of them, people will be like, well, I thought we already passed that, and which is part of the problem of having false expectations and falsehoods in your resolution itself. Going, my question stands. I didn't ask if the Constitution had no teeth. I'm sorry if that didn't answer the question. Basically, there is no step one, step two, step three, step four. There isn't an exact process. You first have to establish good principles, and then you have to see how it plays out from there. That's all I can really say. I don't want to tell you what exactly is going to be step two, because what if it's wrong? What if it's too much? What if it's too little? Who knows? Who knows? You really have to kind of look and see what's going on. Gerard Perry says, didn't Idaho pass a similar milquetoast resolution opposing federal gun restrictions? Maybe. I do know that Idaho in 2014 or 2015 actually passed a version of our Second Amendment Preservation Act where it wasn't milquetoast. It literally banned the enforcement, banned the use of material support or resources, manpower, etc., in Idaho for the enforcement of any gun control measures enacted on or after January 1st the following year. So maybe it was 2015 and then 2016 or 2014, 2015. And some people would call that weak because it only takes a small step, but it would actually apply towards any gun control measures that have been enacted since then, and it establishes a foundation. Idaho would need to follow up on that if they wanted, if the people there wanted to address the Gun Control Act of 68 or the National Firearms Act of 1934. But certainly, Idaho, it's against the law in Idaho for law enforcement officers to even provide logistical support to the federal bump stock ban that was implemented in the fall of 2018. So there's a good first step that was passed in Idaho. Essential Freedom says, quotes of liberty are my drug of choice. Absolutely. State legislature earlier this year. I have not seen that. Gerard, if you want to email me at team@10thamendmentcenter.com, I would love to see that and take a look. And maybe it's garbage. Maybe it's great. I don't know. The key, even if the language isn't where it should be, the key on resolutions is that there always has to be a follow-up. There has to be a follow-up to whatever principle you're establishing in a resolution, whether it's on a state, a county, a city, a town level, it doesn't matter. There always has to be some level of follow-up on those. Essential Freedom says, I'm being ignored by the Missouri governor. Eric Nance says, understood, if and agree with you, by itself doesn't do anything. I'd like to see some county conventions myself to start correcting state governments. It's a difficult process. It's a very difficult process. Just taking a look a little bit more. False expectations, says Andrew Nappy. Exactly right. And that's the problem. So Jefferson and Madison didn't claim that they nullified the Alien and Sedition Acts. They never did. Even in the resolutions themselves, they called on the other states to join them. They literally just said, here's our position. Let's all work together and do something else. And that's what should be happening in Virginia and elsewhere right now if they want to take a path that is focused on non-binding political statements. Anyways, I hope you guys found this interesting. I hope it was educational. That's most important. I hope you learned something. If you really want me to keep talking about Virginia, this wasn't necessarily directly related to what's going on in Virginia today, but of course it is about Virginia because we're talking about the Virginia resolutions. There are a lot more things. Maybe we could do an episode where we're literally walking through the process of drafting a resolution, some important essential points that should be covered in the language of every resolution, the things that should be avoided in the language of resolutions. I'd be happy to do that with you guys. And I mean, it might be boring, a little wonky, but if there's enough people that are interested in that, I'd be happy to do an episode or maybe just a supplemental video kind of talking about that in a little bit more detail. But all that aside, more importantly, I hope you have a very, very Merry Christmas. I'm going to spend a little time with a small number of friends and family, both on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. kind of a half day of work on Wednesday, but back to it shortly after that. I'm really looking forward to some time off and probably eating a little bit too much of stuff that I'm not supposed to be having. I hope you have a wonderful time as well with whoever you happen to be spending time with, whether it's your loved ones, yourself, your pets, or whoever. It doesn't matter. I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. I'm so very grateful for you spending some time with me today. Of course, if you support the show, smash the like button. Join our membership program for as little as $2 a month. 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members is where you can sign up for that. I know there are a number of you out there who are members already. I'm very grateful for that. I'm even grateful for the people who aren't members. I just think it's really exciting that you decide to spend some time with me. Anyways, thank you. Merry Christmas. I'll see you next time here on The Path to Liberty.